Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Benedicts against the Village of Hanover Park. Mr. Madden.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. I've had a number of arguments before this Court, and I can safely say that this is the first time I can start the morning by stating the parties seem to be in agreement. The parties are in agreement that a village or municipality is not entitled to legislative immunity from Section 1983 claims, that a grant of dismissal on 12b-6 grounds to a municipality under legislative immunity would be improper, and that the district court in this particular case provided no alternative grounds or reasonings as to the grant of 12b-6 motion to the Village of Hanover Park. The error, it would seem, is manifest. Sadly, that's where our agreement disappears. Defendants invite the court then to exercise its plenary power to review the record below and provide a searching inquiry into the case. And what it really amounts to is an attempt to shift the burden to the plaintiff, both substantively and procedurally, in a way that appellant thinks is improper. For two reasons. Number one, defendants suggest that there's a glaring deficiency in the failure to allege conduct, a specific conduct on the part of the plaintiff to bring this case under 1983. Two things to really be said about that. One is, as it's framed, it can be viewed entirely as a patronage case, in which case the emphasis or the focus is not upon the plaintiff's conduct, but upon the question of whether the position is one of a policymaking position or a non-policymaking position, and whether defendants can show that politics is a proper requirement for that position. And two, if we even look at the case in a normal, more typical fashion of political retaliation, plaintiff suggests that the complaint fully satisfies allegations of conduct. In this case, the village president, we have some direct quotes from him making the conduct clear. He says, "We have staff choosing sides, and when they choose sides, they have to go." And then after his election in speaking and after the termination of plaintiff's employment, speaking about the termination, saying she chose the wrong side. On 12b-6 motion, plaintiff suggests that this is entirely sufficient, both as a direct statement of the plaintiff's conduct.
Suppose the president is dissatisfied with the performance of the administrator of the EPA and directs the administrator to fire half of her staff, and she does. Staff members have a claim under the First Amendment. The president doesn't know or care anything about the politics of the staff members, but his design is to hobble the administrator by reducing her staff.
True.
The president does care about the administrator, a political official. Now, of course, this happens every time an administration changes. The attorney general goes out, and so does all of his staff. And a new attorney general and a brand new staff comes in. If I understand your argument, you're saying that all members of the attorney general's staff have First Amendment claims.
No, it would depend on what positions they held within the staff and whether those positions were appropriately deemed a policymaking or confidential.
No, on my hypothetical, they're not policymakers. They're not confidential. They're just there processing reams of paper. And in my EPA hypothetical, the reason the president has done this is because he's dissatisfied with the head of the EPA and wants to make life hard for her.
Yes. Well, in that particular case, you haven't shown the causation for the political animus that we have in this case.
The president is dissatisfied with the head of EPA for political grounds. Doesn't give a fig about the staff except that it's her staff. All right, that's what it looks like here. The village board is dissatisfied with the village manager on political grounds and decides to hobble the village manager by reducing his staff.
Well, that's not the case here, Judge, because they out and out dismissed the village manager. They got rid of the village manager. So
then,
it was more than that.
It was more like the change of the attorney general, and they've got rid of the attorney general and the whole staff of the attorney general. But I'm trying to figure out what the First Amendment claim is of the staff if the politically responsible official who can be fired on political grounds is either hobbled or fired or disciplined or embarrassed, and often that involves changes in staff. And the person who's doing the firing or hobbling or embarrassing doesn't know beans about the staff members, but does want to do something with the staff. Do the staff members have First Amendment claim? It sounds like you're saying, yes, every member of the Attorney General's staff, when Attorney General Mukasey went out the door on January 20, 2009, every member of his staff had a First Amendment claim because they were all gone.
Well, under Branty, I think if they are non-policymaking and non-confidential positions, then yes, they have a First Amendment claim.
Why? Branty says they have a First Amendment claim if they're fired for their politics. In my hypotheticals, and so far as I can tell the facts of this case, the person who's doing the firing hasn't a clue about their politics, but simply wants to clean the office out and provide the new incumbent with a free choice of staff.
Oh, no, to the contrary, Judge. In this particular case, the statement from the village president is that she chose the wrong side.
Look, that's like saying Betty Smith, who was Attorney General Mukasey's secretary, chose to work for Mukasey, right? We're firing the people who chose to work for Mukasey. They obviously weren't firing anybody who chose to work for Eric Holder. Eric Holder was coming in.
Right. And that decision to associate with Mukasey as opposed to somebody else, or the decision
so
to
like
not to refuse
it. Sounds like you're saying that in my hypothetical, the Attorney General's secretary's rights under the First Amendment were violated. Everybody in his office rights were violated because they chose to work for Mukasey. And when President Bush lost the election and Attorney General Mukasey lost his job, they were nonetheless protected. Even though the President Obama and Attorney General Holder didn't know or care about their politics.
Well, I think you've gone a step farther than where we are in this particular situation. Here, we're on a motion to dismiss. We just have a complaint in
front
of us.
Well, that's exactly what I'm hypothesizing.
Well, but you're also adding an additional step, suggesting that there is, in fact, no causation that could be proved to show that this
causation was that this person chose to work for Attorney General Mukasey.
Yes. And that's the freedom to associate.
And the president lost the election, and the new president cleans out the office.
Yes. And if the decision is made because they chose to associate with Mukasey, then yes, I think that's a violation.
So of course they associated with Mukasey. They didn't, it was not anonymous, right? They knew they were working for Attorney General Mukasey.
Absolutely.
Who was appointed by a Republican.
Absolutely. And this goes back to the distinction between policymaking and non-policymaking positions.
No.
If it's a non-policymaking position.
Cases like Branty refer to firing somebody because of that person's politics. You have any case where a staff is cleaned out because of the politics of the supervisor?
Mm-hmm.
Any case. I was looking for them. I couldn't find them.
Well,
this happened on January 20 of every fourth year in D.C. Maybe 30,000 people lose their jobs on this kind of basis.
Mm-hmm.
Happens every day in local, state and local government.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find a single case that supports your proposition. Now, maybe you found one.
Well,
isn't it?
I think the cases in our brief where we talk about the patronage cases, for example, question being, you know, were you a Republican or weren't you a Republican, are sufficient to show that. I mean, the whole principle behind Shachman is that these lower-level clerical individuals have an entitlement to be free to associate with whom they please, and the administration of the government can't be justified on patronage grounds, such that you can't just simply because you're now the elected official go in and clean house of every single position within the government simply because you think that that's your prerogative. On those lower level non-policy making decisions, I think the case law that we've cited in the brief is clear. If it's a non-policy making position, you do have protections under the First Amendment from that cleaning house. Now, whether it happens as a matter of practice in Washington every fourth year, and whether those individuals decide to assert those rights or not, or they make evaluative judgments based on where their political aspirations may lie, or they just want to do something else for 4 years until maybe their political winds change, that's a different question. But on this particular case, we have an individual plaintiff who had worked there for 14 years, and the allegation is it's a non-policymaking decision in which she is specifically targeted by the village president for her beliefs. She chose the wrong side.
Well, has any case actually relied on perceived affiliation, other than the one line the court wrote in Soderbeck about the plaintiff being a presumed ally of her husband?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question, Jeff.
I said, has any case actually relied on perceived affiliation, other than that one line the court wrote in Soderbeck about the plaintiff being a presumed ally of her husband? That really gets to the heart of your situation in terms of her being, in terms of this perception of political affiliation.
It could, but Soderbeck is the sheriff and his wife, and,
right.
And the presumption there is that he is so closely associated. So what we've tried to do in the complaint here is outline the contours. I mean, this was some of the failings in the Puerto Rico case that the defendants cite. The failing was to outline the contours of the political atmosphere in which the plaintiff operated. So we've taken pains in our complaint to show the historical animosity between the village president and the Progress Party and the Community Party, her 14-year involvement with the village manager, who's a member of the Community Party, and we've specifically alleged that she is known not only just to be friendly with, but to be associated with that village manager. And on our complaint, we're entitled to all the reasonable inferences that implies as well. And when you couple that with the president's statement that she chose the wrong side, we have a clear allegation of conduct on her part that takes it beyond just mere speculation. But also there are, and I apologize, the name escapes me, I'll get it when I sit down, the case in which the individual quickly changed party affiliation in hopes to save his job, but what at all times was regarded as a Republican. I think that meets Your Honor's question about perception. Even if the perception is inaccurate or wrong, the illicit activity here is the motivation to take revenge or make employment decisions based on the political affiliation. Whether that turns out to be true or not might be a different question, more appropriately for summary judgment disposition on causation, but certainly for fact pleading issues. Notice pleading issues here in federal court. I think we've met that, and the perception is sufficient. We've also outlined, Your Honor, in the complaint, the other retaliatory actions of the village president and the defendants in not only ousting the village manager, ousting the assistant village manager who had a community sign in his front lawn, the issue with the director of one of the departments in which he is, there's a the schedule for the village meeting has him announcing his retirement, but he's never agreed to retire, and then it's quickly withdrawn as an error, but then he is not reappointed to his position. He was the campaign manager for the Community Party. So I think when we have this constellation of facts, as we've alleged in the complaint, we go beyond the merely speculative into the realm of a targeted decision by the defendants in this case, which brings us under the framework of Elrod and Baranti. It could be viewed as a patronage case, but also if we're to be held to have alleged or needing to allege specific conduct, I think we've done that as well. Simply by virtue of the defendant's own statements. As to the individuals, we contend that the district court erred principally in failing to acknowledge the pre-ordinance activities. I think the statement in the district court's opinion is that this was actions taken solely in an ordinance form, and that's not what our complaint is about. The village manager was vested as the administrative head of the village. He alone had the power to make decisions on this classification plan, determine within the budgetary constraints which positions are eliminated, which ones are created. When the defendants got into power and summarily ousted the village manager and did not replace him, and then took it upon themselves to take on his administrative responsibilities in creating a classification plan that they felt fit within the budget, they acted administratively. Administrative acts are not entitled to legislative immunity under Rattery and the other cases that we've presented. On those grounds, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Brandon Lemley. I represent the defendant appellees in this matter. There are principally two questions before the court. There's an ancillary third question with regard to state law claims, but really just two questions. One, has the complaint stated cause of action for First Amendment retaliation, particularly as it regards the protected conduct element of a First Amendment claim? And two, if it has stated a cause of action, are the individual defendant legislators entitled to legislative immunity? There are two elements to a First Amendment claim, and particularly a First Amendment political association claim. One, did the plaintiff engage in protected conduct? Two, did that conduct cause the adverse employment action? Now, most cases, most political association cases, the first element, the protected conduct, it's easy to plead, it's clearly pled, it's easy to prove. An individual was a Republican, an individual was a Democrat, the political support is clearly stated. That's not what we have here. Nowhere on this complaint is plaintiff alleged to have engaged in protected conduct. Counsel has argued extensively that merely satisfying the causation element is sufficient. I would posit that in response to your question, Judge Williams, that a case that you actually ruled upon when you were at the district court, Kyle versus Morton High School, does address an issue substantially similar to this. In Kyle, an individual was fired from his job, and a board member, after the board met, said, "You were fired, quote, because of your political and advocacy issues." The complaint alleged that the causation was because of the political and advocacy issues or the perceived political and advocacy issues of that individual. Yet nowhere in the complaint did the plaintiff identify what actual political activities he engaged in. This court affirmed, and it held that while the plaintiff had alleged causation, he had not alleged the underlying protected conduct. And, quote, "it is not enough to allege mere retaliation due to improper motive. There must be an allegation of protected conduct." You also more pointedly asked, is there any case that says there's a perceived as claim? There's numerous cases that we've cited in our brief that go on to say you have to actually engage in protected conduct, and typically that's brought out in a First Amendment speech setting. However, those cases are not so far removed. We did cite to a district court case, and I admit there's a district court case from an outside district. However, that court, Good is the name of it, explicitly looked at whether or not one can have a perceived as political activity claim. And the court there held that not only is there no perceived as claim, in fact, it had reviewed the case law, could find no cases in which there was a perceived as claim, and granted the individual legislators qualified immunity because it could not find a perceived as claim. So what we have here is a situation in which plaintiff has not alleged any protected conduct. In fact, their brief, their reply brief, summarizes their claims in terms that are unrelated to engaging in protected conduct. Quote, "plaintiff was terminated by the defendants due to their vocal belief that the plaintiff was associated with a political adversary. Yet nowhere do they allege that she was politically connected to a political adversary. So they argue defendant's Hanover Park Progress political machine and cleaning house following its electoral win violated the plaintiff's rights by terminating her because they perceived her to be a longtime political ally of the village manager. Yet again, all we have is an allegation with regards to her association through employment.
Now, in the Branty case, the Supreme Court said public employees need show only that they were discharged because they were not affiliated with or sponsored by the defendant's party. Why doesn't this support a claim that she was viewed as a not affiliated with Craig's party?
Because, in fact, she has yet to prove that she actually engaged in the protected conduct. So it's a question. The question you're posing is whether you have a First Amendment claim where one does not engage in First Amendment protected activity, whether mere perception is enough to garner First Amendment protection. Now, I posit that based on all the case law that's arisen out of this circuit, including Zaranti versus DeLuca, one of the primary elements is whether or not you've engaged in protected conduct. Now, most cases do not look to the issue. Most political patronage cases don't look to the issue of whether one engaged in political conduct or protected activity. But in most cases, it's evident. In most cases, it's clearly pled. In this case, it would have been the simplest element to plead, and it's nowhere pled. In fact, when you read all of the briefs in the case, it becomes evident that what's really at issue is not the plaintiff's own political views. Many of us work with, are friends with, people who are politically active. Many of us work with politicians themselves. We're friendly with politicians themselves. Yet that fact alone does not imbue everything we do, every relationship we have, with First Amendment protection. Instead, what we have is a mere relationship with village manager Hummel. Now, plaintiff has not alleged that that relationship itself had any political nature. There's nothing that there was advocacy due to that relationship. Instead, it is a straight employment relationship. Employment relationships simply are not the type of cases in which First Amendment protection applies. Now, plaintiff has cited to a case from the First Circuit Court of Appeals arising out of an appeal from a Puerto Rico case. I believe the case is Padilla. But if you look at the facts of Padilla, they are clearly different. In Padilla, the individual was the assistant to the mayor, was a longtime assistant to the mayor. He also engaged in political campaigning for the mayor and the mayor's chosen successor. And there the court held that there was enough of an issue of fact as to whether or not the individual had engaged in the protected conduct and ultimately had engaged in, had satisfied the causation element. Here, simply stated, on the facts that had been drafted by the plaintiff herself, those allegations do not exist. Moving on to legislative immunity, it's clear that legislative immunity applies to the individual defendants. And there is an issue where the public record actually disagrees with an allegation in the complaint. Specifically, two of the defendants in the case, the public record reflects that they actually did not vote on the ordinance at issue. At this point, we're not raising an issue with it, but we do bring it to your attention. The decision to vote on this ordinance eliminated the plaintiff's position, but she wasn't the only one. It also eliminated the position of the assistant village manager, and the entire village attorney and his staff. This arose out of a lack of funding that was caused by a line item veto by the village, or pardon me, by the mayor himself. Unlike the case of Rattery, which arose out of the Seventh Circuit, the line item veto did not involve specific salaries for individual positions. Instead, the line item veto addressed funding for departments themselves, including the department of the village manager of which the plaintiff was employed. Subsequently, what we have is a situation in which there's a lack of funding for the village manager department, and salary decisions need to be made. One of those salary decisions that was made was ultimately what positions need to be eliminated to address this fact. An ordinance was prepared which deleted the position of not only plaintiff, which was the executive coordinator to the village manager, but also the village manager's assistant, and as Mayor Craig wrote in his veto, the reason for eliminating these positions is that the village manager doesn't need multiple levels of assistance in dire economic times when the village's projects and the projects run by the village manager have been reduced. Ultimately, this case bears striking resemblances to Bogan, the Supreme Court case. In Bogan, as I understand the facts from the decision, the mayor in the case proposed an ordinance which called for freezing the salaries of all municipal employees. It also called for the reduction in many, many positions within the village. Subsequently, a committee met and proposed an ordinance which would have actually eliminated the position of the plaintiff herself. Following that, the proposed ordinance by the committee was taken up by the full city council, and they voted to adopt the ordinance, and it effectively eliminated the position of the plaintiff. That is the same situation that we have in this case, in which the plaintiff's position was eliminated, as were others. Now, the plaintiff was not replaced, as was argued by the plaintiffs in the case. Within the village, they already employed a village clerk. By ordinance, they created an office of village collector, which is an office that's established through the Illinois Municipal Code. The office of collector is allowed to share the same office as the clerk, under which they're allowed to collect money owed to the village. They're allowed to track it down. They're allowed to bring it in. Essentially, the village collector acts as a fiscal watchdog on behalf of the village. Now, in addition to the duties performed by the clerk slash collector, she picked up some of the duties of the plaintiff. This was not the type of, quote, one-for-one replacement that was addressed by the court in Bogan or the court in Bagley versus Blagojevich. Ultimately, it is our position that legislative immunity simply does not apply. Unless there are any further questions, for these reasons and those stated in our briefs, we would ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court below.
Thank you, Mr. Lemley. Anything further, Mr. Madden?
Good point, Your Honor. I think one of the linchpins for the resolution of this appeal is counsel's statement that he represents to the court that plaintiff has yet to prove she engaged in protected conduct. We're on a motion to dismiss at this stage. This isn't a summary judgment case. There have been no depositions. There's been no discovery. There's no evidentiary findings. It's entirely inappropriate to put plaintiff to the proof of her pleadings at the 12B6 stage. Counsel had mentioned in his discussion the cases of Zarante and Padilla. Notably, Zarante says quite plainly that neutrality is protected in the same way as opposition to a political party. But more importantly, both those cases the court should take notice of are summary judgment cases. Again, there's a full factual record developed in those cases, which hasn't happened here. And this continual theme from the defendants self-perpetuates. Because what we hear from counsel today, well, this classification plan was amended because of concerns out of a line item veto in the budget. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence as to why these particular cuts were made. There was a line item veto, which changed the budgetary funding within certain classifications or departments, but then when the decisions are made on how to affect that budget, okay, which positions will be cut, which people will stay, which people will go, those are administrative decisions. And notably, counsel doesn't inform the court and can't yet because there's no record of it. Who made those decisions? According to our complaint, those decisions were made by the defendants, the trustees and the village president, after they had summarily fired the village manager, the only person under the village code who had the authority to make those employment decisions, to make those administrative decisions. So, again, counsel's arguments are all framed as if we are at some more advanced stage of this litigation than we are. The plaintiff is entitled to all the presumptions, all the facts well pled in her complaint and all the reasonable inferences therefrom. So, again, when we plead that the village president says we have staff choosing sides and that she chose the wrong side, we have made an allegation of conduct for the purposes of pleading. If there are no other questions from the court, plaintiff thanks the court for the opportunity and asks the court remand.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement.